I had to recognize that accessible yoga is what I learned from my students. I'm not coming into that relationship as the one with all the knowledge and all the wisdom, and the student is the one with nothing. It's like they're not an empty cup. Every student is a full being and totally okay as they are. And they're coming to you maybe to learn something, but we don't need to come at them with like this, first of all, very ableist mentality that we're going to fix people, even that we're going to improve them, but rather that we're sharing. And I think they're sharing with us simultaneously.
You're listening to the Yoga Teacher Resource Podcast. Knowledge, techniques, and inspiration for your teaching and your practice. I'm your host, Mado Hesselink. If you're a yoga teacher who loves learning, is passionate about spreading the benefits of yoga, and desires more resources to support your teaching, you're in the right place. Let's get started with today's episode.
My guest on today's episode is Jeevana Haman, founder and director of Accessible Yoga and the Accessible Yoga School. Jeevana is the author of Accessible Yoga, Poses and Practices for Everybody, Yoga Revolution, Building a Practice of Courage and Compassion, and a new book, The Teacher's Guide to Accessible Yoga, Best Practices for Sharing Yoga with Everybody, which he and I discuss in the conversation you'll hear today. His books, classes, and trainings offer support to yoga teachers and yoga therapists in finding ways to bring creativity and collaboration into their teaching while still respecting the ancient yoga tradition. If you enjoy this episode, you may also want to check out episode 185 from 2022, where Jeevana and I discuss the relevance of the Yoga Sutras in the modern day. Just a minute ago, we were talking about your new book and your writing process and how you've been spending time reflecting on your early days in yoga and how you first got started. And so I'd love to hear one story or anecdote that you've recently been reflecting on about that time.
Yeah, sure. My grandma taught me yoga when I was little. I kind of rediscovered it later in my 20s when I was really struggling. I was an AIDS activist and it was like really difficult time as a gay man to have so much death and illness around me and so many friends dying. And so I went back to yoga and I found this incredible teacher named Kazuko Onodera. She was helping me in so many ways. But what I realize now reflecting, and I've been writing about it, is how she showed me that yoga and meditation are part of life. And that I realized most of the time we spent together when I was with her over the period of, I would say like 5 years of like really intensive study with her, mostly we were just like cooking and gardening. Those were the two activities that we did like most of the day. And then we'd go into a little asana practice and a meditation. But it was like most of those hours were spent gardening and cooking. And I realized she was showing me so much through that. She was kind of teaching me about nourishing myself and how important that is. Like kind of not just self-care, but like survival almost. You know, I think I had lost touch with that. And I think something happens, I don't know, for me, at least in my 20s, and you and I both have, you know, older kids too, and understand like it's a challenging transition from childhood to adulthood. And it's like, I really didn't know how to be in the world and handle all my big feelings and, you know, the stuff that was going on. And so I think that was what really got me so interested in yoga and meditation. It wasn't so much that part, but like the way she had connected it with surviving and thriving and being in the world and growing food and cooking food and eating it in a meditative way, you know, and caring for myself.
Most of us growing up, we're not explicitly taught how to handle our big feelings. Yeah. I think kids these days are getting a lot more education. Not all of them, but some of them are getting so much more guidance on how to do that than when we were younger.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we were younger, it was not happening. There was like no, I mean, just no conversation about, I mean, I remember my dad went to therapy and it was like a big deal, you know, like that he would go to therapy. It just was so different. Like in the 70s, you know, I really grew up in the 70s. So yeah, it was a different world. I mean, still, I think our kids have different challenges too. I mean, humans, we've always had to deal with that, right? Like, how do we handle our feelings and our thoughts? And in a way, that's what yoga and meditation is for, right? Like giving us support for that. Like how to be a human.
Yeah. How to manage the inputs.
Yeah.
And
decide what to keep and what to let go of?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about meditation in particular and how my early days, so much of it was self-judgment and self-criticism. And like, that's where my mind tends to go there. And I think a lot of people do. But in a way, I was using that. I was using meditation techniques to like beat myself up more. Like, I'm not doing it right. I'm not concentrating. I'm distracted and all this stuff. And then I think it took me a while to come to an understanding that it's really more about this inner relationship and like trying to cultivate a more positive and supportive inner relationship. And like you said, to be into choose, but just like support the positive things in my life instead of beating myself up. It's like life's hard enough. Mm. We don't need to use meditation to make it harder.
One of the big differences between when you and I grew up and now is the amount of input, the amount of opinions, the amount of information coming in that we're exposed to all day, every day. And the yogic practice of pratyahara is like incredibly important in a way that when I first started practicing, I could have no possible conception how important that would become. Like, that's a huge practice for me. What am I choosing not to allow in because it's too much and it's not helpful to have too much? So when people first start teaching yoga, or maybe they've been teaching for a while, the tendency is to seek information, which is great. When I first started teaching, it was hard to find information. You know, there was a few books, and then maybe some teachers would come travel to your town, but like had to like look for it. And now there's more information than you could possibly consume.
Yeah.
And there's more opinions than you could possibly implement. And a lot of those opinions are the opposite from each other. So newer teachers, maybe even teachers who have been teaching quite a while, but maybe lack a strong center with their teaching, are bombarded with opinions. And a lot of those opinions, I would venture to say most of those opinions are really well-intentioned, right? They come from somebody's lived experience saying, here is what I have learned about teaching yoga, and here is my understanding of how to do it well. But these raw opinions being thrown at yoga teachers, it's not supportive. It's not uplifting. It tears them down internally. I don't think that's the intention. One big challenge I see is how do we help them accept themselves as they are and see themselves as worthy, see themselves as capable right now without needing to have the skill set to do this and this and this and this all at the same time, but right now, and to grow from there, from a place of feeling inspired to grow because the skill sets that they're developing are going to help more people versus I'm not worthy unless I can do this.
Yeah. Oh my God. There's so many great points you just made. I have so many thoughts about that. That's a big part of my new book, actually. There's a whole section on imposter syndrome, which was really about that. Like what my journey was to taking the seat of teacher and how hard it was for me because I'm a very insecure and shy person. And so it was like, I had to get over myself. And it was a real struggle for years. And I actually think it's often the most sensitive people, often people with marginalized identities too, who feel like they can't take that position of authority and be the teacher. And so I think it leads to kind of a continual, like a cycle of, you know, having a lack of diversity and representation in yoga teachers and therefore in yoga students. Because the teacher will attract students who are like them. So, I mean, it's so important, I think, that what you're talking about, this question of insecurity and feeling capable enough to be a teacher. And one of the things I say in the book is that you can't become an experienced teacher unless you allow yourself to be a beginning teacher. right? How do you ever get there? You can't jump there. You have to learn. Like, that's a normal process of anything. And I think there is this expectation, like you said, there's so much information out in the world, but there's also this kind of expectation that you're automatically an expert. And I think that's dangerous. Like, I have kind of a pet peeve about one thing, this idea of like master teacher or master class. Like, that term kind of bothers me because I feel like we don't have to be masterful. You just have to be, you have to be sharing your experience and what you've found, you know, that's all we can do. And I think if we can make it clear that we're sharing from our experience, that could avoid that situation that you're describing, which is that we're being bombarded by all these experts, when really what we're being bombarded by is people's opinions. And I think it's really beautiful actually to look at the history of yoga a little bit. And I try to do that in the book, go back into some of the texts that I've studied and recognize that there's actually contradictions within yoga history as well. There's a lot of differing ideas and very different like themes within yoga itself. I actually, one of the things I really enjoy doing when I train teachers is talking about what is yoga, because I'm not sure that there is one definition of yoga. You can talk about the word yoga, but I mean just the practice, the definition of the practice. I don't think if you got a group of yoga teachers together that you would agree on a definition for yoga, because it depends on your tradition and what you've studied and what books you like and what sources you read. So I think yoga is different than other, quote, jobs or professions. Yoga is a spiritual tradition. It's not like physical therapy, you know? So I think we have to also recognize that the power that rests in our hands is different. We're talking about spiritual practice, right? It's a very different thing than some other kind of form, some other similar looking practices, right? Like physical therapy, for example.
I think part of what you're talking about is the fact that yoga is multifaceted, nuanced, and amorphous. Our culture wants authority and clarity and linearity, whatever the term is, but it wants a linear path.
Yeah.
And so when we find ourselves, hey, I love yoga, let me do a teacher training, let me learn about this.
Yeah.
And then boom, I did the teacher training. Maybe I got a little bit of a sense of, you know, clarity and a linear path. But as soon as I get out there and I start listening to other voices, I realize, oh, whatever I learned in teacher training was probably not like the end all be all answer. Right. And now I'm overwhelmed. I'm confused. I'm maybe even feeling paralyzed. So I think the question is, how do we develop the confidence to relax into not knowing, to relax into the fact that there's all this gray area?
Yeah.
We need confidence for that, right?
Yes, we need confidence. This book is about supporting yoga teachers and on that journey. And the way what I'm approaching it in is as a relationship, that if we approach teaching as forming relationships with our students, I think it changes. It changes what it means to be a yoga teacher a little bit when we start to recognize the student's role and responsibility in that relationship. It also shifts that dynamic. I'm not coming into that relationship as the one with all the knowledge and all the wisdom, and the student is the one with nothing. It's like they're not an empty cup. That is an illusion. Like, they're full. Like, every student is a full being and totally okay as they are. And they're coming to you maybe to learn something, but we don't need to come at them with like this, first of all, very ableist mentality that we're going to fix people, even that we're going to improve them, but rather that we're sharing. And I think they're sharing with us simultaneously. And I think for me, I had to recognize that accessible yoga just is what I learned from my students. You know what I'm saying? Like, I literally learned all of this from what people showed me, what they wanted, what they could do or couldn't do, what they were interested in. So I dedicate the book to my students for that reason, as my teachers, because I really feel that. I feel that my students are my teachers. And I think to come into the relationship of teacher and student differently can help teachers to relax a little bit and recognize that you have information and so does the student, and you can join together and create kind of a, what I call it, like an alchemy. The alchemy of yoga can occur in the midst of that relationship. You know, I mean, it's not that the teacher shouldn't study and we should do our best to prepare, you know, and I don't think we have to beat ourselves up about that, but do your best, you know, like continue to be a student always, like keep learning. It's great to take trainings and study with different people, like different lineages, like really try to be open to very different practices. That has helped me a lot, because I was trained in a very traditional guru lineage and I stayed in that lineage for almost 20 years. And then once I kind of opened my mind to like other ways, I realized that actually I learned so much about my practice and my lineage from watching what other people do. It's like, oh, you're doing this similar thing, but different. And so you could start to see kind of underneath it, maybe, like what are some of the themes and kind of essential threads that are there, I think, through the yoga teaching. And that helped me a lot.
I love this idea of approaching teaching as a relationship. And I think at the same time, we can also apply that to our practice. If we think of our practice as a relationship versus like some linear path that is going to get us somewhere. Because when yoga is taught that way, I think it does a disservice to the practitioner, whose life and body is going to keep changing. This seems to be at the heart of your message, is like, let's learn yoga in a way that we can keep using it as our bodies and brains and circumstances change.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I always go back to, this is a spiritual practice. And one of the themes that I see throughout the teachings, and I see it in many of the philosophical or all of the sources that I study, like in the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the sutras, even in the Pradipika, I see this theme of yoga as spiritual practice, and that we all have that spirit. It's there for all of us. And that what we're trying to do is, and it's not a separate thing. You know, this idea of sometimes when you say spiritual practice, it already feels like, wait, you know, that's the world of religion, or that's something separate. But what yoga does so beautifully is it says that's your most essential self. So you have that already. And then it's like the practices help us to like reconnect with it in different ways. And that changes day to day and throughout your life in terms of what's going to help you do that. And like when you're young and energetic, maybe an intense asana practice is what you need to help you get there. Or because of your personality or the way your mind works, that you need that physical intensity. And then maybe not. Maybe you're not that personality type, or you're older or you're disabled and you want something quieter and more inward. Neither are better or worse than the other, but the fact is that, you know, hopefully they're helping you to reconnect with yourself.
One of the chapters in the Teacher's Guide to Accessible Yoga is teaching as practice. And I really appreciate that. It was one of the biggest surprises to me when I first started teaching, the way that my relationship to teaching was its own practice. I would love to hear a bit about the aspects of this relationship that have been most meaningful to you in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that makes me very excited, which is how yoga is so amorphous. And I want to say, like, everything is yoga and not at the same time. It's like you can make it yoga if you bring conscious awareness to it. So in a way, if you bring conscious awareness and focus and reflection to your teaching, then that becomes a practice. And so that's what I think you're saying. It's like I started to realize how much I was learning about myself. Like I was, like I said, I was very shy. And I always say, like, as an aside, by the way, shyness, I think, is a form of egoism. Like I was really obsessed with myself and in a weird 20-something way. And so I kind of, you know, I realized teaching and like forcing myself to do public speaking, basically, which was like the last thing I ever wanted to do. It just totally shifted my relationship with myself. And I learned so much about myself through that process. And it was just so incredibly useful. So that practice of teaching and being in front of a group, like that just, that was probably the best thing for me to do at that age, like to really challenge myself in that way. And also to realize that I had a skill, I wouldn't say skill, but like a way to share something I love with people. Do you know what I mean? Like that's the other thing I realized about teaching is like, it gave me something to focus on, which we've talked about before, just like the importance of having something that you love in your life and a form of service, which is a way to then share that with others that feels generous and loving. So like teaching became a form of loving service for me, and it still is. It's something that I love to do it. And it just, I feel like not only is it a practice, but it's an amazing practice that helps me feel better, you know, almost all the time. I mean, not always. Sometimes I still have experiences where I'm having to reflect on, well, that didn't go very well, or I didn't do that great. But I don't know if that makes sense. So yeah, teaching is definitely a practice. And the other part of it, I'm gonna have one more weird side angle, which is ethics. Like I keep thinking about that. The other theme for me in the book is that, like, how do we actually practice yoga? And I think it's by really following yama and really reflecting on it. Is this an ethical thing? Like, am I doing this in an ethical way? Do you know what I'm saying? Am I causing harm? Am I stealing? Am I being greedy? Like, am I being attached? Like, how am I using my energy? These questions of the yamas to me are kind of central with making yoga practice in life. And so I have to reflect on that also.
And all those themes are going to come up in your teaching.
Exactly.
I think in the book, you were also talking about how at first, when you learned about the yamas, that you saw them as more prescriptive, like here's how you can be ethical instead of here's how to have a relationship with ethics. Here's how to inquire, right? There's this outside information. Here's what other people think is ethical. And then there's your inner experience of alignment with your own framework, your own ethical framework. And I think that's a relationship too, because we learn about ethics from the outside, but not everything that we learn from the outside actually aligns internally. So we have these experiences, we have the things that we learn, and then we have something kind of unique that just exists within us. And all those three things need to line up. Well, I mean, the what we learn from the outside doesn't have to be part of that, but it's information. It's good information to help us evaluate those other pieces.
Yeah. Actually, I think that line that you refer to is a quote I used from Judith Lasseter, because I interviewed a bunch of teachers for the book. And
That's right.
I quoted her in that section. I interviewed Judith to talk about ethics because she really has brilliant things to say about it. But and I released that interview. I would recommend people listen to her. She's just amazing. But I think that ethics, it's about helping us build that inner relationship. Exactly what you said. The point is with ethics, I think that usually we think of ethics as those external guidelines, like laws or rules that we have to follow. And what I've found over time is that actually they're more like internal boundaries that help keep me safe. And so in a way, it's like such a gift that the ethics offer support for my mind, you know, so that I can always reflect back on them. It's like a touchstone, you know, to help me keep my peace of mind, which is what I'm trying to do in yoga, right? That's what our goal is here. And I just think shifting my relationship with ethics has changed everything. And I would say that's one of the biggest lessons I learned through teaching. You know, it's like you said, it comes up in teaching all the time. People always push you. Like, I don't know, maybe just me, but like I would always be challenged in some way. Some issue would come up And I always have to like think, how am I going to respond to this? And so often the answers are already there. You know, if I just think, okay, what would cause the least harm? What is honest?
When you say shifting your relationship with ethics, are you referring to transitioning the focus from externally imposed ethics to internally felt ethics? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And I think that the prerequisite for doing that is recognizing that there are cultural messages or just even interpersonal messages, even interfamily messages that often go unexamined. And part of the framework of yoga is the invitation to examine the messages as they're coming in and evaluate them.
Yeah.
And test them against that internal barometer.
Exactly. That's a great point. And I think I gave an example in the book about my teacher, Swami Satchidananda, and how, you know, I'd studied with him so intently and like lifted him up as my guru, but then realized that he'd been having sex with his students. And I had ignored that information as long as I could. And then all of a sudden one day, it like clicked in my head, like, wait a minute, what am I doing? Like, this doesn't align with ethics. This is opposed to what he's been teaching me. There's contradiction here. And so I realized that was that really was a light bulb moment for me in terms of recognizing how I can actually support myself by following these ethical guidelines and not imposing them on myself, but actually trusting my gut. Like, this is, I guess internalizing them, like you're saying, and really reflect on, is this external situation in alignment with what do I feel internally? And so recognizing that his actions were not aligned with how I feel. And so I could no longer consider him as my teacher because of that. And it doesn't change the fact that I learned from him. It's just that I no longer see him in that way, right? I see him as, you know, a human who was a great teacher, but had many, many problems. And I think in spiritual life, especially, these are such powerful practices. I think ethics need to rise up to the top. And that when they don't, we see a lot of abuse happening. And it's obvious in yoga, like, there's just been so much abuse. And I think we see the big pictures abuse stories, but I think we also miss a lot of the smaller abusive things that happen in yoga. Even when it comes, even just simply making yoga accessible, the whole idea is based, to me, is an ethical question, actually. You know, is, do students feel harmed by you? Can you create a situation that supports them as best you can to feel welcome? And to create a supportive environment, that feels like an ethical question, to not cause harm, right? To not shame people, to not actually injure them, even emotionally or physically. To me, that's all accessible yoga really is can you apply the ethical teachings of yoga in the way that you teach them and practice them? And it's a big question.
So back to the idea of teaching as a relationship with your students and really respecting what your students bring to the relationship and using that as maybe the center of your teaching. Many, if not most, of our students are going to come to the yoga class with the assumption that yoga equals asana.
Yeah.
And that's what they're interested in. And it's a pretty rare student who's like, yeah, and I want to learn about yoga ethics too.
I think that's almost never happened. Yeah.
Right. This is it does happen occasionally. I've had it happen, but it's rare.
Yeah.
But I think this is the bigger conversation, and the one that's going to be really useful, I think, for yoga teachers listening is, what's our responsibility and how do we bring ethics into our classroom without being a preacher, without spending all this energy trying to convince our students of something that they're not ready for or not interested in?
Well, I mean, to me, the short answer to that is to be an example and to teach by example. And so I don't think that you have to speak about ethics to have ethics be a priority for you, just like around accessibility. You don't have to talk about accessibility. It's something you can do. You can create spaces that feel welcoming. You can actively invite and include people to the practice. And I don't think it's something you have to always say out loud. It's just, it comes through your words and your actions and the way you teach. So that's kind of what the bulk of the book is, actually. I mean, there's, you know, most of the book is on teaching asana and practical tools. And the reason I did that is because I think teachers need that, right? We need that practical part. But I feel like it's all in service of this other question of, aligning our teaching with the teachings of yoga. And so approaching yoga as a practice, teaching yoga as a practice is doing that. And I think it's great to teach asana. I love asana. And I think that is where almost everyone starts. And that's what makes yoga so amazing. I mean, asana is what simultaneously makes yoga accessible and inaccessible, because it creates this very like kind of pragmatic, grounded, embodied, you know, tangible thing that we can do. And so much of spiritual practice is not like that. I mean, most spiritual practice is very intellectual or kind of, I don't know, ethereal. And like, there's like a preacher or someone who has some kind of power or authority over you, but yoga is very different. Yoga is like, here you go. Like, here's a thing you can do in your body. You don't really have to understand a lot of this philosophy. You just move your body like this and breathe like this and you'll have this experience. And that's what so makes it so accessible and like, yeah, tangible, I guess. At the same time, it can become an obstacle if it's perceived as, you know, the only way or the, you know, those big asanas sometimes are obstacles because they're like, oh, I could never do that, you know? And so I think that keeps a lot of people away. So there's that both and there, that asana is amazing and is also can be an obstacle to deeper practice. But, and obviously, you know, it's working because look at, I mean, millions and millions of people are practicing yoga today. So there's something really, really powerful about asana. And I don't think there's anything wrong with just going to yoga for asana. Like, that's fine. You're still doing yoga. And it may be all you ever do, but there's an opening there for more for people, I think, if they want to explore more subtle practice. And ironically, those subtle practices are actually even more accessible for many people because they often don't depend on physical movement at all. You know, but it might be more challenging because it depends on ability to sit with yourself or to have stillness, which is really where we're working towards. Yeah,
I think there's overlaps here with that earlier conversation about the often conflicting messages that yoga teachers are receiving. You have a responsibility to teach the full spectrum of yoga. Mm-hmm. You have a responsibility to honor the roots of yoga. All of this is important stuff. Right. But I think that when it's not digested fully, when it's not like, okay, let me take this into my practice and like work with it internally. No, I got to immediately turn around and do this and do it right and get it right. It's like the opposite of helpful.
You know? Yeah.
It just puts more pressure on. It's not coming out of yoga teachers in a natural way. And then one of the teachings that has been emphasized in the yoga system for so long is non-attachment. And in Western culture, we hear that. We're like, what?
Yeah.
That's terrible. I don't want that. But it's not because we want to be zombies. It's because attachment leads us away from our center.
Yeah.
And part of this attachment is being right, doing it right, getting it right. It's really like a form of people pleasing too, right?
Totally. I totally go there. I go there myself. I was talking about at the end of class, like when the students are leaving and they're like, great class, you know, oh, so great class. And if someone doesn't say anything, you're like, oh my God, you know, they didn't like it. They thought I was terrible. Like, I'm a terrible teacher. Blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just our mind. Yeah. Like, what is it? Negative bias you said earlier. I mean, we just totally, I maybe not all of us, but I do that for sure. And I think a lot of us do, just really sensitive to judgment. And I mean, I have so many thoughts about that. Well, I like the first thing you started saying, I think it was really important though, that the conflict that happens when here we have students coming who want asana, but we're being told that, oh, you have to give them the fullness of yoga. How do you balance that? And I would say, again, I go back to this idea of relationship mm-hmm. with students, and that, you know, sometimes it's like you can't do everything in one class. And I really find that it's the students I have for years that I can build rapport with and help more. And if someone wants to come to me for one class, that's great. They might mostly get asana. I'm going to do a little bit of centering in the beginning, and I'm going to do some subtle practice at the end of every class, like always. So I'm always going to have like a few minutes of some deeper practice there, but it has to be appropriate to those students. And that they might not get much from that, but over time, I think students will see that I'm committed to that, right? That I'm, why is he spending time doing breathing practice every class? Why do we spend 1 minute in meditation at the end of every single class? Like there's something happening there. And I think over time, they'll start hearing that and seeing that in what I do. And I think that's fine. It doesn't have to be, that's the other thing I say in the book. You don't have to give everyone everything all the time. You know, it's like, part of the mastery, I hate, there's that word I don't like, part of the becoming experienced teacher is recognizing when to stop.
Yeah.
You know, like not maybe the student's limit, but maybe just giving them what they need right now. And that's, it's okay if it's just asana, like that's, it's fine. And but you know what gets me though, is I worry that the teachers themselves don't have a support system to go deeper. Like I don't, and it's okay if the teacher themselves is just into asana, like that's fine too. But I feel like I find a teacher, like just explore, go read more books and read the actual texts, like read the Yoga Sutras and the Gita and the Upanishads, the Pradipika. Those are really accessible in a way. They're actually readable. I think it can just transform our experience of the practice and allow us to feel more confident, to have a connection with that lineage, and like, or just like find a teacher that supports you in that way.
I also think it's okay for it to be subtle.
Yeah.
If you are studying philosophy and you are practicing, you're working on subtle practices, but it's not yet bubbling out of you, you don't have to force it into every class.
No.
It is still there. If you are studying it, if you have a relationship, it's there. And at some point, you're not going to be able to stop. You're not going to be able to help yourself from sharing it. And that's the point where it's really going to land with people. But if you are sort of forcing yourself because of outside expectations to share certain aspects of the practice that other people have told you it's your responsibility to share, I think that is something to kind of sit with and ask yourself, is this really in service of my students that I'm doing this? Or is this like, like what you were saying earlier, is this for my own ego that I want to be doing it right?
Yeah, I think that's totally true. It just reminds me again of this process that you go through as becoming a teacher, which is like, it's okay to be a new teacher. Like, it's okay. It's okay to make mistakes and do your best. And I think allowing ourselves to make mistakes is huge. You know, and I think back to many mistakes I've made over the years. And then I kind of balance that out in my mind. And I think, you know what though? I was mostly kind. And that was a conversation I had with Jason Crandall about what he recommends in terms of accessibility, which was an interesting conversation I had for this book with him, because I don't think he's really normally interested in that world. But he talked about being kind, you know, like that's one thing you can do. And I love that. Just like that a teacher can be welcoming and friendly. And like, that's huge. That is huge. Just to invite people in to be kind, whatever comes up, like they don't like it or they're struggling or whatever. It's like you're listening, you're open and kind. And I just think that's an amazing service that you can offer people. It's like a kind ear, a friendly face, and a nice kind of creating an environment that just feels welcoming and safe-ish. I know we can't always make everything safe for people, but that is, it's an enormous service that we can provide as yoga teachers.
It's really, in a way, an antidote to a lot of the pain and suffering in the world. If everyone in the world had the guiding principle of kindness, helping them make decisions every day, we would live in a completely different world.
Yeah. I mean, kindness, it's one of those words that it seems so syrupy sweet and on one hand, but there is a depth to it, I think, which is that if, as a teacher, I think that our job is to not be seeking, actually non-attachment, to have non-attachment to our students in a sense that we don't need them to fix us. And so that's one thing I talk about in the book is boundaries. And so one of my boundaries is like recognizing that I don't need anything from my students. When I started to realize that, it freed me so much to actually be there more for them. It's like, I'm not, well, what I need for them is to pay me, actually. So there is an exchange. I mean, I think that's important, but like, if you're paying me, then I can be there to serve you. And I feel like hopefully that payment balances that kind of energy exchange in a sense. And I think that's why payment is useful. You don't always have to be paid. That's fine. You can volunteer if you want, but I think there has to be some exchange so that you don't need them to like you. You don't need them to thank you, right? You can be there, serve them kindly, and then they can just walk away and feel that they were supported and served and held in some way. And that kindness for me, so I guess all I'm saying is kindness, I think, can be seen in a broader sense that I've done my work. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've done the work on myself to take care of myself. I found what I need elsewhere. Like, I have in my own practice, I have my my husband and my friends and whatever I do for self-care in my life that allows me to be present with my students so that I'm not there just needing them to like me, because I think that's a dangerous game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what you were mentioning earlier about kindness can have the reputation of being syrupy and shallow. And what that says to me is that it's fake, but true kindness is incredibly deep. And it starts with self-kindness. It starts with having your own needs met.
Yes.
So that you don't need anything and you can really meet people where they are with compassion. That's, you know, maybe a more traditionally yogic word, compassion. Maybe kindness is like the expression of compassion.
Ah, I love that. I think that's true. Reminds me of concept of service or karma yoga, which is really also central to yoga, I have to say. If you look at all different teachings around yoga, I think karma yoga becomes a central theme, which is that you do all these practices so that you can be of service to others. And that doesn't mean that you're giving in a like boundless way. It just means that you have taken care of yourself so that you can be present with others and love them and care for them without always thinking about what you get back, you know? And I think that's what a yoga teacher can do that is almost a miracle in this world, is to be of service to others. I see many people do it, actually. I see a lot of caring professions, you know, like I think of nurses or flight attendants and wait staff in restaurants, people that are just so service oriented. And I think it might be the most beautiful thing that we can do for each other as humans, which is, I think, bring kindness. I think that's what you're getting at with that word, is service. Actually, can I read a quote? I have in my previous book, Yoga Revolution, you know, I talk about this quite a bit, and there's a teacher named, I don't know if you know Rachel Naomi Remen. She's a great, it's a short quote if I can find it. She says, helping, fixing, and serving represent three different ways of seeing life. When you help, you see life as weak. When you fix, you see life as broken. When you serve, you see life as whole. Fixing and helping may be the work of the ego, and service, the work of the soul.
Beautiful.
Isn't that nice?
I think that's a perfect place to wrap up.
Yeah.
Do you have anything that we didn't talk about that feels like it needs to come out right now, or anything that we did talk about that you want to circle back around to and emphasize?
I mean, what a great conversation. Thank you. Like, we touched on all the things that I love so much, you know, service, which is, and kindness. I love that connection. I'll be thinking about that more. Also really practicing yoga in life, like through my teaching and in all my interactions, and allowing ethics to be my internal support as I navigate my way through. So thank you. Thanks for that. All those reminders today. I'm excited to digest all that more.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for the service that you do in writing these books and leading the trainings that you lead. I know that they are your form of creativity, and I know they've made a big impact in the world.
I appreciate that. Thank you.